So welcome back, everyone. This is, can everybody hear me okay? Is the mic working? Okay, good. So this is session 4 of Buddhism in a Nutshell. And just getting my, so everybody might know we just had a puja in here, so they're taking down the offerings for the puja. So we'll have a little bit of activity going on to help us concentrate. Puja? Very good question. So puja, spelled P-U-J-A in English. And there are people behind me who know much more about this than I do who can correct me if I get this wrong. It's basically a ritual ceremony, and they're done for different reasons. It's more of a traditional, so we have these classes which are more like informal, westernized classes. Then we have the Sunday teachings, and a puja is more of a formal ritual where you'll say prayers and mantras. Some of them are for a specific purpose. And even though they're more ritual and formal, the best thing to do if you want to learn more about them is come to one. You don't have to understand Tibetan, or you don't have to know all the prayers and the mantras. If you're interested, we have them on our calendar, and you can come to one without even really knowing what's going on, and just kind of see what it's all about. I think they're very beautiful, very beautiful to listen to, very beautiful to participate in. So certainly feel free to come to one if you're interested in learning more about them.
You're very welcome. No experience necessary.
Okay. So we're just going to take a moment to... Any other questions about that? Okay. About an hour, maybe a little more than that. Depends on what kind it is, but about an hour, I think, is about normal. Okay. So is anybody here for the very, very, very first time? And just as a reminder, if you have a cell phone, put it on your meditate setting. And we're going to start off by with just a brief meditation. Kind of settle our minds, get over all the busyness of getting here and everything else that we've been doing today. Go ahead and sit comfortably on a cushion or on a chair, whatever you prefer, with your feet comfortably resting on the floor or on a cushion if you're sitting in a chair. Comfortable cross-legged position if you're on the floor. Think about the different points. Even if you don't remember them all, try to remember some of those points of the 7-point meditation posture that we talked about. Especially the back straight, that's a very important one. Feeling that your spine is, people talk about it like as if your spine is a stack of coins stacked on top of one another, or a stack of blocks. Think about it like your spine is supporting your body, not like the rest of your body is holding your spine up. Jaw and mouth relaxed, your tongue just resting on the upper palate just behind your teeth, your front teeth. So focus your attention on your breathing. Just breathe naturally. I think there's a tendency when you're focusing on your breathing to breathe a little bit unnaturally. And that's okay, that's going to happen. But as you get more practice, you might find that it's easier to just breathe naturally without any effort. And just watch your breath. Focus the mind on the rising and falling of your shoulders and chest as you inhale and exhale gently. And allow your mind to settle and become calm and present, ready to engage in meditation. And create an altruistic motivation for the meditation session. think that you are meditating not just for your own individual benefit, but you're taking the time now to meditate and develop your mind to become a wiser and kinder person, able to be of benefit to all beings. Focus your attention at the opening of the nostrils. Pay attention to the very subtle sensations as you breathe in and out through your nose. You can feel certain sensations as the air passes, as the small hairs move. Cooler sensations as you inhale, warmer as you exhale. Don't follow the air into your body or out into the surrounding environment. Place your attention on the sensations associated with the breath at the opening of your nostrils. Your job is to keep your attention firmly placed on those sensations only. As you inhale and exhale, mentally count each inhalation and exhalation together as one. Count from 1 to 10, concentrating on those sensations. When you reach 10, begin again at 1. If you become distracted, if the mind wanders to other things and moves away from the point of concentration, then begin again at 1. Even if you never get past 2, it's not a problem. The point is to train your mind to focus on one point only. And this concentration can take some practice to attain. When you start to attain some mastery over the technique, then once you reach 10, count backwards from 10 to 1. Then start again, counting from 1 to 10. All right. Life gives us lots of opportunities to practice, even here. So, what we're going to do this evening is continue a discussion of some of the topics we previously introduced in some of the earlier sessions. We're going to talk a little bit about karma, which we were discussing a lot last time, and how it forms the basis for Buddhist views about ethics. We're going to talk about the principal aspects of the path to enlightenment, which is something we mentioned a little bit in the earlier sessions when we were talking about the Four Noble Truths. So this will be a chance to kind of review some of the main topics we've talked about earlier and to go into them in a little bit more detail, some interesting topics. So we had a couple really interesting questions, a couple really good questions last week. We were talking about the mind and different levels of mind and the continuity of consciousness. This idea that, you know, our minds are, well, first of all, we have different levels of mind. We have our gross level of mind, we have our subtle level of mind, which are kind of similar to the conscious and subconscious that we're normally talking about in the West. And then we have this very subtle level of mind, which is a little bit interesting. It's a little bit different from, you know, I'm not sure if we have a really an equivalent, directly equivalent concept in the West. But it's the idea that this very subtle level of mind, this pure nature of mind, pure, clear and knowing nature of mind, is what carries these karmic imprints that we have. So, and they're not actually part of that pure level of mind. They're kind of like reflections on a lake, or like we talk about impurities in water, where the water is still there, the pure water is still there, and these impurities can be removed if we know how, if we have the right techniques. And when we talk about this continuity of consciousness, basically what we're talking about, on the simplest level, it is a pretty simple idea. It's just the idea that each moment of thought we have, each moment of consciousness, is produced by a previous moment of consciousness. So we kind of see how one thought leads to another thought, leads to another thought, leads to another thought. The idea in Buddhism is that this is going on to a degree that we're not necessarily aware of consciously. We talk about there being 65 different moments, individual discrete moments of mind in a single finger snap. You know, so all the stuff that's going on in the background in your mind, all the things you're noticing, observing, all this information your mind's processing, all these internal processes that what we don't really, you know, become aware of. And then again, taken to a much greater level, we have the idea that this continuity of consciousness goes back and back and back and back, not just to birth, but even before birth, and then even before conception, that this the mind isn't something that's produced physically by our physical bodies. The mind is a non-physical entity. It's produced, can only be produced by a non-physical entity. It can only be produced by a previous moment of mind. And so this is the basis for the Buddhist idea in rebirth. And so we had a really interesting question from the lady who was sitting over here. I'm sorry, I forget her name. But she asked if there are an infinite number of these streams of consciousness, these continuities of consciousness. So you can think of it as, are there an infinite number of sentient beings, an infinite number of beings that possess this consciousness and mind? Does everybody remember that question? Did I get that right? Is that pretty close to what she asked? Okay. And it's a really interesting question. I said I'd have to kind of talk to some of the experts here and find out some more about that. And it does get very interesting because it's kind of related to the question. I think she asked the same question about whether there's we have individual consciousness or whether there's this collective consciousness that's all kind of pooled together. And you know, I would definitely say that the idea of a collective consciousness, the way I've heard it discussed elsewhere, isn't really something we talk about in Buddhism. So maybe you've heard different ideas about there being just kind of like one giant pool of consciousness that we're all really a part of, and we just kind of think that we're individual. You know, there's a lot of different ways that this idea is discussed and explored. So what we do say in Buddhism is that in terms of karma, which is carried by this very subtle level of consciousness, that we do all have our own individual karma, right? So that's one way in Buddhism that we would definitely say there are individual streams of consciousness. So like we all might have shared experiences. We've all done actions in the past, virtuous actions that have caused us to have a human rebirth and be born in a country where we have a lot of conveniences and a lot of you know, really nice things. Our lives are, you know, getting around and finding food and shelter is not as difficult as it is in other places. We've got a lot of good things going on, or we've done virtuous actions in the past that have resulted in us living somewhere where there's a place like this. You know, whatever your level of interest in is, whether you're just mildly interested in Buddhism or whether you're actually practicing this as a way of life, it's kind of nice that you live somewhere where we have this center with very qualified teachers like Geshe Gelug. So we all have some type of common experiences in the past, common actions in the past that have resulted in similar karma that have all put us in this room tonight, right? But those actions are individual to each of us. So it was my actions that have resulted in my karma that put me here. Your actions resulted in your karma that put you here. Even though they're similar, the causes are similar, you're not experiencing someone else's karma. So we would say in that way that there are these individual streams of consciousness. Does that make sense? Now what you have to be careful about, though, is taking that too far, because one of the things, we'll talk about this a lot next week, but one of the ideas we have, which in Buddhism is definitely viewed as a misconception, is we tend to view ourselves and others as very, very distinct, as individually existent, inherent, self-existent, existing from their own side, not dependent. You know, we view ourselves and others as having a very independent, inherent existence. A simpler way to look at it is that, like, all the characteristics that I might see one of you having, in my view, they're all coming from you. They're not necessarily my perceptions, right? We don't sit there and say, oh yeah, you know, I think that Joe's a nice person because that's my opinion of him. We say, oh, Joe's a nice person, right? That's a characteristic that he has. So you do have to be really careful when we talk about these individual streams of consciousness and we talk about ourselves as being individual people. You have to be really careful about not taking that too far and viewing us all as completely separate, independent entities, not in any way interdependent on each other. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay. And that kind of relates to the idea of, you know, are there an infinite number of sentient beings, an infinite number of these continuities of consciousness? Because, again, we can take that a little too far, too. It helps in a lot of ways, especially if you're thinking about compassion. You know, you're trying to develop compassion. We talked about in the first class how, you know, we all want to be happy and avoid suffering. We all want more of the things that we consider, you know, bringing us happiness. We want less of the things that we look at as causing us suffering. And that's something that we have in common with all human beings, all sentient beings. I mean, even ants are going to do things that promote their well-being. They're going to try to avoid things that make them suffer. And so it's a really powerful thing to think about, a really powerful thing to meditate on, how you have this. It's not just you wanting to be happy and avoid suffering. This is something you have in common with everybody around you, everybody you care about. And not just that, but all living beings, all these ants and animals and flies and birds and everything. We all have this basic connection of wanting to be happy and wanting to avoid suffering. So if you're meditating on that, thinking about that, thinking about there being a vast, you know, contemplating just how many possible sentient beings there are, not just humans. I mean, we think about, oh, there's millions of humans in the world, but think about how many insects there are in the world. I mean, it really blows your mind to think about how many insects, how many creatures there are living in the oceans, right? And so trying to develop compassion for all those creatures and thinking about, you know, this vast number of sentient beings, almost thinking of it as infinite, is certainly beneficial in those kind of scopes. But if you really want to get to the nitty-gritty, you know, you really start want to get really specific about it. So are there a finite number of beings? Are there an infinite number of beings? Well, now we're getting into a really deep discussion about what sentient beings are, what these streams of consciousness are. And again, you can take it a little too far and start having this view of these beings as being specific, existing from their own side. You know, it gets, when you get to that level of exploration about how things exist, then we have to start talking about how things really exist and what our perceptions are and how our perceptions are a little bit different. So I was trying to think of an analogy for this, and this is probably a terrible analogy, so feel free to laugh or come up with a better one. But no, I promise, no more Knight Rider analogies. Yeah, I'm done with those. I'm really, yeah. That was, hopefully it helped. You remembered it, right? So maybe it was helpful.
I told my wife about it.
All right. So no, this is not a night. This is not a 70s or 80s sitcom adventure television show analogy. But so if I were to say, so how many varieties of vegetables called tomatoes exist in the world? How many different varieties? What's that?
Bunches.
Yeah, because oh, there's lots and lots and lots. But then, okay, well, we're going to get technical here. Technically, the question itself I would have to revisit, because a tomato is a fruit, not a vegetable. In cooking, we consider it a vegetable, but technically, taxonomy, if you talk to a biologist, it's a fruit. So now we kind of have to rephrase the whole discussion, you know, and get into this whole thing, well, why is it a fruit? It looks like a vegetable. I cook it like a vegetable. You know, well, no, actually, because of the way it grows and everything. So we get off in this whole different direction. And that's when we talk about some of these really metaphysical topics, like, you know, are there an infinite number of sentient beings or a finite number? It kind of takes you off into a whole discussion of, well, what actually is a sentient being and how we're actually, you know, not these discrete, individual, completely separate, self-existent things. So it just gets off. It becomes a little bit more, there's not a simple answer, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at. So hopefully that's a little, I'm sorry, I guess she's not here this evening, but that's kind of, you did. Okay, good. I'm sorry, I had you mixed up with somebody else. But, so is that helpful? Okay, that's okay. Would you like to, let me, because I want to, because this is an interesting question for me. So, you would pass this back.
Oh, kind of. I think I asked the question. Okay. I asked, are there an infinite number of consciousnesses,
mm-hmm.
or are there a finite number of consciousnesses? Is mm-hmm. that the question you're referring to?
Yes.
Okay. I get confused when, And I was reading something this week also, and it was talking about the fact that everybody is everybody else's mother.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that everybody is either, that we are all in some past place, we have all been related, or fathers, mm-hmm. or mothers, or brothers, or sisters, mm-hmm. or nephews, or aunts, or uncles, or mm-hmm. whatever. And so I what I want to know is there a limited number of, for want of a better word, consciousnesses or souls? Is there a limited number of these essences out there?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it a finite number?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm confused.
Yep. And that's where it's basically, I mean, maybe the simplest way I could put it is there are some certain things that the Buddha specifically did not talk about or did not give an answer to. Just expressed in a certain way. So, for example, you know, I believe what he said, and I couldn't tell you the exact wording, but something to the effect of he's, you know, clearing all the obstacles to knowing from his mind and reaching the state of enlightenment. He's able to look back along his own stream of consciousness, just like you could, you know, remember what you had for dinner yesterday, maybe. I don't know if I could, but, you know, potentially you could. You could remember a conversation that you had with somebody last week. He can look back past this lifetime. If you want to accept the fact that, okay, let's entertain this idea of rebirth and previous lifetimes, a Buddha who's cleared away all these obscurations to knowing is actually able to look back farther than I can or ordinary beings can along this stream of consciousness into previous lifetimes. And the Buddha has said he's looked back and back and back and back and never seen a beginning. So that's the basis for this idea of there being an infinite stream of consciousness, no first cause, everything having some cause of a previous something, previous moment of consciousness. And so if you could think about it, just the number of sentient beings that you know, you can kind of easily extrapolate that into the idea that, well, if we've all existed, or our stream of consciousness has existed since beginningless time, that by itself, even just among the people you know, opens up the opportunities of us all having been everything to each other. Okay. And then the whole idea of, well, so does that mean, are there an infinite number of us or a finite number? That gets into kind of the whole area of, well, we have to talk about our terms and definitions of, yeah, sentient being. Yeah. So does that help a little bit?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the basis for it. Okay, good. Good. It's really interesting. Yeah, the questions get really interesting. Okay. Anybody else on that specific topic? Okay. Yes. Okay. We have a couple. Okay. Can we pass the mic around? Yeah. It's really helpful.
I can understand animals mm-hmm. and humans exchanging a consciousness passing from one to the other, but I really struggle with insects.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To think that an ant or a cockroach would have a stream of consciousness that had ever been human
mm-hmm.
or could ever become human,
mm-hmm.
that's beyond my fathoming.
Mm-hmm. So, I think probably a thorough answer would get into, you probably need an understanding of karma that's way beyond anything that I understand. But if you imagine the idea that you have this very subtle level of consciousness, right? This pure nature of mind that's like a clear mirror, right? That reflects, you know, so carries these karmic imprints on it, like reflections on a lake or like reflections on a mirror, right? But they're not actually part of the mirror, but they are carried on that mirror. They are reflected by that mirror. That's what we call, I mean, and that's the idea of Buddha nature, of us all having the capacity to become Buddhas by being able to clear away the obscurations and just reaching and accessing that pure level of mind. And then the idea is that everything else that we become, you know, is basically dependent on those karmic imprints that are carried. So that pure nature of mind, we're not saying that, and this, I'm going to explain this to the best of my ability, which is really limited, but we're not saying that, in other words, a mosquito carries all of the mental capacity that a human does. It's one of the reasons why we say it's so fortunate to be a human, because we have a much better capacity to understand ourselves, to understand phenomena, to study, you know, the Dharma, to learn things. An insect, a mosquito, doesn't have that. But it's kind of like, I'm trying to think of a good example. I'm thinking of, you know, if you're interested in computers, this might equate a little bit to where you have like a, okay, this is going to be a really geeky computer example. So if this doesn't work for somebody, let me know and I'll try to come up with something better. But so you have compressed files on a computer, right, that have in them enough information to turn into a whole big video or photo or program or document or something, but the actual file itself is much smaller. So similar, don't take this analogy too far because it might not be a good one, but similar to the way that that compressed computer file carries all the information or can generate this much larger, more complex file. Or think about a seed. Here's a better one. No, let's not go to computers. Let's just talk about seeds. In a seed, a tiny little acorn is all the information that you need to generate an oak tree, right? So it's not the size of an oak tree. So you could imagine in that mind, that very subtle level of mind, carrying all these karmic imprints from beginningless time, there is enough information to develop into the mind, the subtle level of mind, and then the gross level of mind that we experience as us. And then also, based on those karmic imprints, whatever develops or whatever you do become, whether you become a tiger or a mosquito or a human, is dependent on causes and conditions, or conditions also. The karmic seeds, we would say, are the cause. The conditions are, you know, just like with a seed. You have the seed, but in order to grow into an oak tree, that seed needs the proper soil, it needs sunlight, it needs water, right? Some kind of source of water. So you have this very subtle level of mind carrying all these karmic imprints, encountering the conditions that would be necessary. So this human mother and father coming together and twinkling their eye and everything, that would be necessary to produce a human body that then, and this is where we get into how the connection between the body and the mind, that this mind, this very subtle level of mind, enters into, and then everything else generates from there. Was that at all helpful? Or did I just muddy it up even more?
Well, I still, the difference in order of magnitude is beyond me.
Yeah. It's a little bit beyond me, too. That's why that's the best explanation I can give. But the idea that the essence, that very subtle level of mind carrying these karmic imprints, could be carried by a mosquito, could be carried by a human, could be carried by an animal. Now, these less subtle level of mind, let's call it, there's the very subtle level of mind, and there's the subtle level of mind, the gross level of mind. So especially that gross level of mind that we experience, and even the subtle level of mind that we're experiencing, couldn't be carried by a mosquito's physical brain. But that subtle level, that compressed file, could be. So maybe, hopefully that helps a little bit. That's a good question, though. Yeah. And if that's not helpful, if it's still bugging you, let me know, and I'll try to get a better answer, a better explanation. Yeah, I'll try to get bugging. Puns are allowed. Good one. Thank you. Yes, that's good. Thank you. Okay. So, we had another really good question, which I believe you asked, about the implications of karma. And so I think what your question was, you know, is if you accept this idea of karma, then could that lead somebody to, you know, for example, I think you used the case system in India and the idea that, and maybe it was somebody else, I have a hard time sometimes remembering who asked the questions. But so the idea, like, so in India, there's a very, if you may be familiar with this, somebody, you might be more familiar with it than I am, but they have a very stratified, or has been, or maybe still is, a very stratified social structure where what you can do, the opportunities you have, the people you can associate with, is very strongly connected to the family that you're born in. So it's a very, very strongly stratified, and, you know, especially in previously in the past, has been very limiting, you know, as far as, you know, you can't go to this place, you can't have this job, things like that. So, you know, and some people are treated very poorly because of that, or in the past have been treated very poorly because of that. And so would you just say, well, if you believe in karma, then wouldn't you just say, well, of course, they deserve that. You know, I shouldn't have any sympathy for them. You know, other things that you see, other situations you see people in that are very, very unfortunate, would you, from a karmic standpoint, look at that and say, well, you know, of course, they deserve that. I shouldn't have any sympathy for them. Is that kind of along the lines of your question? I mean, I think it is a really good question, because that's one of the things we get into is, well, what are the implications of this? You know, and we're kind of taking our previous experiences and Western ways of looking at things and then mixing them in and then adding this stuff to it. When you were asking that question, it kind of popped into my head for a second, a story I heard, but I couldn't really figure out how to fit it in, but maybe it will help explain it a little bit. So a friend of mine was telling me this about this book she had read, and I haven't read the book, so I'm not going to probably relay this perfectly accurately. But this American author had written this book, and she was talking about how she had traveled to maybe India or Nepal, I think, and she met this Buddhist nun who was taking care, and the Buddhist nun was taking care of a young child who had a very severe disability or disease or something, but this young child was obviously, you know, suffering pretty greatly from this disease or this disability. And the author, the American author, said something along the lines of, you know, wow, I feel so sorry for that child, and just really, you know, expressing this tremendous pity for this child. And the Buddhist nun said something along the lines of, you know, well, you know, you don't have to feel so much pity for him because this is his karma. And the American author was kind of taken aback by that, you know, kind of been a little offended by it. It's like, oh, you know, the way the author interpreted it was, oh, well, this nun doesn't even care about this child who's suffering so much because she's just saying, oh, it's just his karma, right? And so, but here's the thing. If you think about the situation, and if I described it properly, who was actually taking care of this child? It was the nun, right? So, and all this American author did was kind of go back home and write a book criticizing the nun, right? So not really doing much to help the child. So you have to, and the point of it is, you know, not to criticize the author or anything, but you kind of have to keep things in context. So certainly if you were to take that comment completely out of context, you would say, oh, well, what a mean nun, right? But if you take, what a mean person. But if you take that comment in context of, here's this nun, this person who's devoted their life to this way of life. They've devoted themselves to this way of life, given up a lot of the things that we enjoy, and she's the person who's taking care of this child, dedicating every day to taking care of this child. So within the context of that, what are her actions, right? What are the actions that are resulting from her philosophy? Well, obviously very compassionate actions. So in the same way, when you look at these different concepts like karma, now we say all the time, if there are certain things that you hear here, you know, in this place that are helpful to you, and you want to take those and run with them, and they're helping you in your life, that's great. And if other things aren't very helpful, you can just set them aside. But if you do kind of get a little caught up on things, like, well, wait a minute, this doesn't really sound right, it does help to step back and look at it in a much within the context, the broader context of the teachings. So certainly that concept of karma by itself isn't really meant to say that you, oh, don't feel any compassion for this person because it's their karma that they're this way. It's actually exactly the opposite, that compassion is a really important part of Buddhist teachings. And we're going to talk about that, you know, a little bit this evening. So is that helpful? Yeah. It does really help sometimes. You know, I think there are a couple things that really help. When you come across ideas that you find really difficult or you're having trouble digesting, one thing we talked about is, take a moment to make sure that you really understand the Buddhist definition of these things, right? Because there are a lot of things that we have our Western definitions of, and the Buddhist, the way we use them here is actually sometimes significantly different. So if you're having a hard time understanding something, take a moment, step back a little bit, make sure you've got the Buddhist definition straight so you're not, you know, comparing apples to oranges, but then also try to look at that concept within the broader perspective of the teachings, and that might be really helpful too. All right. So, moving along, we're talking quite a bit about karma last time, and to kind of get into some of the implications of karma and why it's an important concept, one of the important implications is that it's the basis for Buddhist views on ethics. So obviously, if every action of body, speech, and mind is going to have some consequence for us in the future, if everything we're experiencing right now is the result of some previous action, then, you know, it's nice to clean things up a little bit, right? I mean, we obviously want to plant, it would be nice to plant good seeds that are going to grow into something positive, something virtuous. You know, try to leave the room a little nicer for the next person who's going to have to stay in it. So that's kind of the basis for these views on ethics. And one of the main, you know, descriptions of the Buddhist views on ethics is we talk about the 10 non-virtuous actions. So these help connect karma to ethical behavior, and they're general actions to be avoided so as not to create negative karma. Another way to look at them, though, is they kind of tell you, indicate how you should act. The other side of it is, you know, virtuous actions. The opposite would be virtuous actions, thinking of how to act to create positive, you know, positive results. So of the 10 non-virtuous actions, there are 3 of body, which are killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. So killing, taking the life of another, and on a greater level, killing, taking a human life would be considered even a more powerful negative action. Stealing, or sometimes I like this the way this is put is taking something that is not given. So if you take something that is not offered, take something that's not given, that's considered stealing. Sexual misconduct, and this is where we do have a kind of a pretty specific definition. It would be considered, in the Buddhist sense, it would be considered either adultery, so, you know, conduct with somebody who's involved with someone else, or it is included like, you know, assault, right? That would also be included in the Buddhist definition. But it kind of brings up an interesting idea that, you know, if you start looking at what Buddhism considers non-virtuous, there's a pretty practical side to it. So, you know, an example, just by example, if you look at, like, for example, Christian views of ethical behavior, you know, not right or wrong, but just the way, by definition, generally you find in Christian or other theistic religions, non-virtuous action would be something that goes against God's will. Virtuous action would be something that's aligned with God's will, right? I mean, does anybody who's Christian disagree with that? So obviously, in a Christian or a theistic belief, God is the ultimate source of morality. And so our job as ethical beings would be to follow his will to the best of our ability and to avoid doing anything that's against God's will. What we have in Buddhism is more practical based. You know, it is based on the idea of not creating negative karma that's going to, you know, affect your consciousness in future lives. But there are really, you can really relate. I guess what I'm saying is you tend to not find things that are maybe as arbitrary or just based on authority or tradition, like this is the way it is, you know, kind of a thing. So, you know, like when we talk about sexual misconduct, you know, in Buddhism, there's nothing wrong. You know, to me, I always say it's very similar to chocolate cake, the Buddhist view of chocolate cake. You know, it's very, very, very similar concepts. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with two people in Buddhist view, nothing wrong with two people who aren't married having a little chocolate cake together, right? No problem with that. Two guys want to have some chocolate cake together. Two girls want to have some chocolate cake together. Buddha doesn't have a problem with that. Now, if you take somebody else's chocolate cake, right, that's a problem. Somebody leaves it in the refrigerator with a note on it saying it's their chocolate cake and you take it and eat it, that's a problem, right? You get jealous because somebody else is having chocolate cake and you're not, that's a problem. So, you know, definitely some similarities there, but it is more related to your mind, and that's the thing to really think about when we look at this view of ethics and non-virtuous actions. So what kind of seeds are you planting in your mind? What kind of habits are you creating in your mind? How is it affecting you, and how is it going to affect other people? So really, when we talk about this view of ethics, we can look at it, I think, very effectively from that point of view. When we talk about 4 non-virtuous actions of speech, we have lying. You know, obviously pretty easy to see how that might harm you and other people. Harsh speech. So harsh speech, you know, angry speech, anything that would adversely affect somebody else, create negative feelings in someone else, harsh speech. Slandering or divisive speech. I think that's interesting. They kind of put those two together or kind of use that as the definition of slander. But divisive speech, so trying to divide people through your speech. You know, there's an interesting book called Games People Play. It was written a number of years ago. I don't remember the name of the gentleman who wrote it, but it's about transactional analysis. It's about different types of you know, games that people play, unproductive games. And he has these different categories of games that he defines. And one of them is called Let's You and Him Fight. Right? So I'm angry at you, and what I'm going to do is instead of talking to you about it, I'm going to tell him and get him angry at you so that he goes and says something nasty to you, right? So that's divisive speech, trying to divide people, you know, and create divisions between people. It's especially considered non-virtuous to create divisions within a spiritual community. that's considered especially non-virtuous. Gossiping or idle speech. And this is kind of the tough one because when you think about it, if you really start looking very closely at this definition, most of the stuff we do is idle speech. It's not about anything that's really productive. It's we're talking about baseball scores and we're talking about, you know, what kind of ice cream we want to go get and, you know. But so that could be a rough one if you really go by the strict definition. It can be inspiring, though, to really think about it, that, you know, how – if you do want to try to make some of your conversations more meaningful – you know, how often do we kind of just out of habit fall into these not very meaningful conversations? And maybe we could, you know, I mean, certainly thinking about this has inspired me in some situations to try to have a little more meaningful conversations, you know, and think about the stuff that I tend to talk about on an everyday basis and whether it's that, you know, useful, productive. But certainly, you know, gossiping. So talking negatively about other people for entertainment. That would be, you know, certainly something that's a little bit easier to get your head around and see how that's non-virtuous. So then there are three non-virtuous actions of mind. Covetousness, so being jealous, covetous, greedy. I think the opposite of that one is a little easier to think about. Generosity, you know, the more willing you are to give to other people, the more you're avoiding that non-virtuous mind of covetousness. Ill will, so having harsh feelings towards other people. I think there's – I don't know if this is actually from a sutra, if this is something that the Buddha actually said, or this is just kind of a common saying in Buddhism that maybe Shantideva or, you know, arose somewhere else. But it may have been from actual something the Buddha said, but anger, being angry at someone is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die from it, you know, or being angry is like holding on, throwing a hot coal at someone. You know, you're actually the one that's going to be burned, right? So we do have these very strong ideas in Buddhism about how the ill will that we feel towards other people, I mean, who does it really affect, you know, the most? Who does it really affect the most? And that's kind of an interesting conversation to have, an interesting thought to entertain. So wrong views are the wrong views. That's the third non-virtuous action of mind. So this would be having specifically having a completely wrong view on something. You know, like thinking, well, you know, I don't have to be nice to anybody because if it's karma, then my being mean to them is just their karma. You know, it's kind of twisting things around and not understanding them, not taking the time to understand things maybe thoroughly and going off and running with things in an unproductive way without taking the time to understand them. Or, you know, really twisting things around to your benefit, you know, when really you're not using the actual understanding. You know, definitely a lot of emphasis on trying to be careful in understanding the concepts as well as you can so you avoid developing wrong views. So any comments about that? Questions? Okay. And again, the main thing when we talk about this, when we talk about these 10 non-virtuous actions, is, you know, again, it's very easy, I think, to consider, and sometimes we just do this out of habit or out of tradition, we tend to consider ethics in terms of either something that's imposed externally, right? Well, we should act this way because our parents and teachers and other people tell us that's how we should act, so we just kind of need to toe the line, right? Or we think of them in terms of maybe strictly, even in terms of how our actions affect others, which is certainly worth thinking about, but then taking it the step further and thinking about the effects these actions have on us. You know, it's easy to say, well, you know, I know that I don't want to lie because it might hurt somebody else, but you know, it's kind of my advantage. I don't really want to tell this person that I ate their last piece of chocolate cake, so I'm just going to pretend that I don't know, or if they ask me, I'll just say I don't know, you know. And we don't tend to think, oh, yeah, well, I'm avoiding the confrontation. That feels good. But we don't tend to think about how those actions actually affect us and can harm us, you know, creating that tendency to continue doing that, if nothing else, even if you're not really getting into the whole karmic view and rebirth. But just, you know, the more you lie, the easier it becomes to fall back on that. As a method of behavior, I think. And in the karmic sense, the karmic result of lying is that people don't trust you in the future. That people are you know, they won't listen to you even when you're telling the truth. So again, relating all these back to your mind and how they're affecting your mind is really beneficial. So the next topic of discussion for this evening, scheduled for this evening, is getting into the something we mentioned briefly a little bit before, the three principal aspects of the path. We talked about, when we talked about the four noble truths, the fourth noble truth was the truth of the path to cessation. So we talk about how this suffering exists that we all experience in many different ways, the truth of suffering, the truth of the causes of suffering, which are internal. You know, I'm not suffering because someone was yelled at me today. I'm suffering because I allowed that to make me angry. So it's the internal, because I have these habits, these tendencies, these karmic seeds. Again, you want to avoid the extreme of saying, oh, that is how I am. Of course I got angry. I am an angry person. It's not really the Buddhist view. The Buddhist view is you have this habit of anger, this karma that you've created previously to have this habit of anger. But it is something that with practice, with effort, you can get rid of. And then the truth of the cessation of suffering, that these habits that we have, these non-productive habits, these afflictive emotions, these negative karmas, they're not a part of the mind. They are something that can be removed. They're something that with effort that we can remove and that we can actually reach a point of complete cessation from suffering, which is a state of nirvana, a mental state where we've eliminated all the suffering that we experience and the causes of all that suffering. So the fourth noble truth is the path. How do you do that? That sounds really great. Yes, please. How do we do that? The path to the cessation of suffering, the cure to the disease. So in the Tibetan Buddhism, we have what we call the Lam Rim, the graduated path to enlightenment. And the three principal aspects of that path are renunciation, bodhicitta, and the wisdom of emptiness. And I'm just going to kind of hit on these. There's a meditation I definitely would like to get to, if possible, this evening. So I'm going to, you know, kind of talk about these somewhat briefly, and then if we, you know, maybe have some more discussion on them, or maybe have some more discussion next week. Think about them a little bit over the week, and then have some more discussion later. So renunciation. Well, what is that? The literal definition is definite emergence. So it's the state of mind not having the slightest attraction to samsaric pleasures for even a second and having the strong wish for liberation from suffering. So what are samsaric pleasures? Well, samsara is a term that we use for cyclic existence. So we've talked about this continuity of consciousness and this process of rebirth that we go through, right? Being born, living, dying, that subtle level of mind going on to another lifetime, another being, being reborn, going through the whole process again. Ultimate recycling program. The problem is that in Buddhism, there are some definite problems associated with this because it's a cycle of suffering. It's a cycle of suffering that we're trapped into. That, you know, I mean, and again, from the Buddhist view, you know, being born is not really a totally happy event. You know, I mean, I think mother and child both suffer a little bit of trauma in there. Throughout our lives, we experience many, many different types of suffering, physical suffering, mental suffering, discomfort, dissatisfaction, major traumas and minor aches and pains. And then, you know, eventually growing old, becoming sick and dying. I mean, these are not necessarily pleasant events for us. And we're basically trapped in this cycle of uncontrolled rebirth. We don't have any control over our next rebirth until we reach a certain level of, let's say, just as ordinary beings, normal run-of-the-mill ordinary beings that you know, I am and maybe a lot of us are. We're going to be reborn in our next life in whatever form based on our karma, based on positive and negative karma, black and white karma that are following us into this, like they say, following like a shadow into the next life. And so you may be born as a human or you may be born as a mosquito. You know, and the idea is that as long as you're trapped in this cycle of suffering, in this samsaric, this cycle of existence, cyclic existence, you don't have any control over what your next the best that you can do is try to create as many virtuous actions as possible, eliminate as many non-virtuous actions of body, speech, and mind as possible, so that you have the best chance of building up more and more merit, more and more positive karma, so that you have more possibility of having a virtuous life in the next lifetime, of a good life, hopefully having a human rebirth. Human rebirth definitely isn't guaranteed. One of the analogies they use, it's not a very happy one, but one of the analogies, motivating analogy, is they talk about like a yoke that you would put on an ox when an ox is like plowing, and there's a hole in the middle of that yoke. They say, imagine a yoke floating on the ocean, all the oceans of the world, and there's a blind turtle that comes up and surfaces once every 100 years. So the odds of that blind turtle surfacing and putting his head through the hole in that yoke, that's the odds, the chance, the baseline chance of being born as a human. Yeah, not very warm, fuzzy thought, is it? Yeah, I don't like that one much either. But, I mean, if you think about it, think about all this vast number of beings. Just, you know, anybody who's a statistician, which I'm not, I'm more of an English major, but just think of all the possible number of insects there are, all the possible number of creatures living in the ocean, not just animals, not just mammals, but all these other beings. So the actual human population within that number is very, very, very small. And so just the chances by that token of being born a human are, you know, pretty intimidating. So it's motivating because one of the things they say, the cause of being born a human is pure ethics, maintaining pure ethics, avoiding those non-virtuous actions. Committing virtuous actions are what creates the cause for being born as human. So that's the motivation. That's what keeps us going, and you know, on the tough days of trying to improve ourselves. Yes, we have a question. Do you have the mic?
I have it.
You have it. Good.
This brings me back to what I was going to say, and it's kind of funny, but could we have been dinosaurs?
We have been dinosaurs.
I know that story. That's all. That was just for me.
Last time I was here, I asked, and you answered it very well, thank you, about karma being nonlinear.
Mm-hmm.
So to use your blind turtle analogy, is there a rhyme or reason as to when something from millions of lifetimes ago comes back and you're born as a human to deal with whatever or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you were particularly virtuous in your last, when you were here as a human, does it like reduce the chances of you being born as the mosquito? I mean, I'm still a little fuzzy on the
mm-hmm.
subject.
I think the most, two of just the really basic things to get out of this. One is don't take this life for granted, because I think that's the main message that comes across. I mean, you can get it, and it's actually very interesting. You can get into the whole the concepts of purifying karma. Mm-hmm. So there are different rituals that we do, which I think are kind of fun. They're interesting. I mean, I they're very helpful to me. But you know, the rituals for purifying karma, just on a very conventional level, you know, you're thinking about these negative actions that you've done and going through a little ritual. There's a short purification process you can do. It takes maybe 10 minutes where you think about these negative actions that you perform and you say some mantras and you do this visualization of these actions being purified in your mind. And that's, I think, it has some practical benefits. So you can get into a better understanding of those and being able to purify as much, because that's the idea. It's like digging up the seed before it has a chance to grow. So we do have that opportunity to purify as much negative karma as possible. And there are some interesting, metaphysical explanations for actually what happens, how the mind is transferred from one lifetime to another. It's one of the reasons why meditation is considered so beneficial, concentration meditation, because the more you improve. One of the reasons why Tibetans don't have such an aversion to death is because there's a belief that, you know, with enough practice of meditation and concentration, the time of death actually gives you an extraordinary, amazing opportunity to practice concentration and to have an incredible influence on your next lifetime. But you can't just kind of show up and say, okay, I'm ready, you know, I got my shiny new tennis racket, you know, put me up against the pro. You have to practice so that you're prepared for it. And again, this kind of relates to the bigger picture. The two big takeaways are, don't take, you know, a human rebirth in your next life is guaranteed. It's not guaranteed. A human rebirth in your next life is not guaranteed. You don't just pick up wherever you left off this time. That's how rare it's considered. That turtle analogy gives you an idea of how rare and valuable and precious it's considered. That's a term you'll hear a lot, is precious human rebirth. So don't take it for granted. And that's really a big message that comes through. As you know, it can certainly be very depressing when they start getting really into specific about how rare a human rebirth is. But really what to take away from it is, don't take this life for granted. You know, really use every moment that you have to as great a benefit as possible. It can be really inspiring from that point of view if you really start thinking about this. Again, don't take this life for granted. Don't take the next life for granted. You know, don't kind of kick back and say, oh, yeah, I'm a human this time, so I'm sure I'm just going to slide right into that role, you know. You have to work. You have to put effort forth. So what's renunciation? How does that bring us to renunciation? So when we start talking about renunciation, we hear, you know, this is the state of mind not having the slightest attraction to samsaric pleasures. And as soon as we start talking about samsaric pleasures, we think about all the things we like, right? Ice cream and chocolate cake and, you know, soap operas. And really what we're talking about, and again, I think something that's helped me keep this in perspective is the idea that Buddhism is about, there's nothing wrong with wanting things. There's nothing wrong with enjoying things. The big question is, what happens when you don't get what you want? And that's really where we start thinking about attachment. What is your reaction going to be? You know, you're all set to have that last piece of chocolate cake that you stuck in the refrigerator before you came to Buddhism in a nutshell. And you put your name on it, and you put the little note on your refrigerator for your roommate saying, hey, remember, please don't eat my chocolate cake. And you've had that conversation, that very serious conversation with your roommate last week about respecting each other's bounds, and it all went so well. And then after your class, meditating and talking about Buddhism, and you go home feeling very Buddhist, and then you open the fridge, and that piece of chocolate cake is not there. And suddenly you turn very un-Buddhist. So, you know, that's the attachment. It's that, how strong is your desire to get what you want? You know, and that's really what we're trying to give up. And it's a really, you know, it takes a lot of thought. This is where things take a lot of practice. You can't just kind of have an intellectual understanding and say, oh, yeah, that sounds really good. Yes, I'd like to do that. But you really have to be vigilant and be on guard for these situations in your life when that arises. You know, and you're going to watch yourself. It's like watching the train go by. You're like, yep, there it is. There's me being a jerk to my roommate because he ate my chocolate cake. And boy, I wish I could have stopped myself from doing that, but not this time. And then that happens a few more times. And then maybe you start yelling at your roommate one time, and then you remember and you stop, you know, and then change the conversation. And then maybe with a little more practice and over more time, you're able to actually see that coming up and take a breath and then make a different choice. You know, that's really what we're talking about. So that's really, you know, when we get it, giving up the attraction to samsaric pleasures, it's the attachment. It's not being able to enjoy a beautiful sunrise. You know, it's not like if you're a Buddhist, you have to go, oh, beautiful sunrise, I can't look, you know. But it's about, you know, what happens if you wake up in the morning and it's absolutely horrible, raining, murky, dismal day, you know. Are you going to act just as if every rainy morning is a beautiful sunrise, you know. How much did things like that affect? It's like the wonderful tire example that I forget her name, gave us. You know, when you get that flat tire, are you going to let that disturb your peace of mind or not? And that's really what we're getting at. And I think about when we talk about, and it's really definitely, I think a lot of people, when they think about renunciation, you think about it, we tend to start thinking about it from a monastic point of view. You know, like, so you see these people they've given up their clothes and they've shaved their heads and they're giving up all this stuff that we take for granted. And certainly that's, you know, Buddhism does promote a monastic view. If your mind is at the place where you're ready to take up that lifestyle, there are tremendous, tremendous karmic benefits and practical benefits to that. But if you're not there, you know, I mean, what is renunciation? And you could, and an important thing to realize is it's not an external thing. So you could very easily shave your head and give away all your clothes and put on a robe and sit down and meditate every day and be a complete mean person to everybody in your life, you know, and not be, have renounced anything. You could be very, very attached to this view of yourself as a spiritual person, you know. And so when you're sitting there meditating and your spouse or your roommate or your partner or your girlfriend is in the kitchen making too much noise, you know, and you get very angry at them because, you know, and you go stomping in there with a frown on your face saying, "Excuse me, can you be quiet, please? I'm trying to meditate," you know. So it's not an external thing. I mean, you can certainly go through all the external trappings of becoming a very spiritual person and not really accomplish anything at all internally. So that's a really important thing to remember about renunciation. It's not really about the external process at all. There might be external signs of renunciation. There might be actions that you take, giving up that thing that you really, really like, you know, that huge CD collection or whatever it is that has obsessed your whole life and, you know, deciding to give it away to the library. There are certainly external actions, but it's the mental process that has to take place first. And, you know, I think we tend to think about it in terms of things we like and in terms of giving up things that we like, and it seems like a really tough thing to do. And the best, you know, I mean, analogy I came up with is, it's like quitting smoking. You know, I mean, I used to smoke. I smoked for like 13 years. And I would say that I enjoy smoking, but even more than that, I was addicted to smoking, right? I was totally a nicotine addict, and I'll totally admit that. So I would really, you know, if I didn't have a cigarette, a certain amount of time went by, I didn't have a cigarette, I would be craving a cigarette. And certainly at the time when I was sitting there smoking my cigarette and enjoying it, you know, I wouldn't think of it as a unpleasurable thing. You know, I definitely thoroughly enjoyed every cigarette that I smoked. I wasn't thinking about the negative consequences. And at the very least, I would say that I was really enjoying it, right? Definitely thinking about it as if it was something that I would miss if I didn't have it. So now, you know, I quit smoking about like 4 or 5 years ago. Best thing I ever did, probably one of the most wonderful things, best thing you can do is not get there in the first place, but if you ever do get there, great, great thing to give up. So as much as I thoroughly enjoyed cigarettes when I was smoking, do you think I miss them now? You know, do you think I look at them as a positive thing? No. I mean, they're anybody who's ever smoked before and then you quit, right? And you're done with smoking for several months. And there's that one time when you start getting your sense of smell back and somebody walks by you who's just had a cigarette and you get that whiff of it, how they smell. And then the next thing you realize is that's exactly how you smelled for all those years, right? You definitely, that experience by itself will convince you that you're not really missing anything. Convinced me. So that's kind of, I think, maybe a little bit of analogy, another of my bad analogies, to renunciation. You know, where if you're not really ready to give something up, then you're going to have a really hard time doing it. You know, you're going to have a really, really hard time with it if you're not mentally ready to give it up. But if you reach that point where you are mentally ready to give something up and you go through that process and you get past that and you get to a point where you really see and feel the benefits and don't miss it. And that's the whole thing. Looking back on it, it doesn't seem like you've given up something terrible. It doesn't seem like giving up that thing is a hard thing for you now. It's like, oh, yeah, I don't need that anymore. You know, I don't miss it. I don't need it, just like I feel about cigarettes. So that's kind of a, you know, and again, renunciation is a pretty big topic. You could talk a lot about specifically what it is and what it isn't. But the two things to remember about it is an internal process. It's what's going on in your mind, not necessarily what you're giving away in your life. And if you're really at a point where you're ready to renounce something, once you get past it and once you've renounced it, it's not something that, I mean, you know, my experience has been it's not something that you're going to miss. The whole point is just getting yourself there to where you're ready to do it. So that's a little bit about renunciation. So bodhicitta is the next of the three principal aspects of the path. Bodhicitta is the altruistic determination to achieve full enlightenment in order to free all sentient beings from suffering and to bring them to enlightenment. So it's a state of mind where you have this determination to achieve enlightenment, to free yourself from suffering, to get rid of all these obscurations, bad habits, all bad handwriting, everything that is a problem, is a cause of suffering for you. To get rid of all that, fully develop, let all of your positive qualities fully come through. But not just doing it for your own benefit, but doing it because that is what is going to allow you to be of greatest benefit to others. It's kind of you have to save yourself first, right? If you're in heavy seas, the boat just sank and you're in heavy seas getting shoved under by the waves, you have to climb up into that lifeboat yourself first and save yourself first before you're going to be able to paddle around and pull other people up out of the water. Right? And that's definitely that's the view that we have here. And that's what bodhicitta is all about. It's when you have that very strong determination to reach enlightenment so that you'll be able to free all sentient beings. This is very closely related to compassion, the sincere wish that others be free from suffering and all its causes. Again, this is something that Buddhism has a very specific definition for. And I think I'd like to talk about that a little bit more next time, compassion, because I think we have some interesting ideas about compassion. I think in some ways we equate it with vulnerability and weakness sometimes. Like maybe you're giving up certain things or not acting in a strong way sometimes if you're being compassionate. And I think we have some interesting ideas about that that are very different from the Buddhist, you know, very, very clear definition of what compassion is. But a topic that's very closely related to equanimity or to a topic that is very closely related to bodhicitta and compassion is equanimity. Equanimity is the absence of the usual discrimination of sentient beings into friend, enemy, and stranger. And this absence of discrimination derives from the realization that all sentient beings are equal in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. So what I'd like to kind of finish up with tonight, and you know, again, we can talk about these things a little more in a little more detail next time. But what I'd like to finish up with is a meditation. This is a little bit of a longer meditation than some of the ones we've done previously, and it's analytical meditation. So rather than just trying to develop our focus, our concentration, we're going to actually think about a certain topic and meditate on a certain topic. And I really like this meditation because, to me, it really helps, I think, give an idea of what some of these concepts are about. When we talk about compassion, we talk about bodhicitta, we talk about equanimity, what's really at the root of it and what are we really getting at? So I want to go ahead and finish up with this. And again, we can talk about some of these things a little bit more next time if we want to have a little more discussion. So just sit comfortably. Again, this will be a little longer meditation. And it's okay to move around a little bit. You know, we definitely don't have to sit perfectly still while you're meditating. You can try to be quiet so you're not disturbing people around you, but you know, certainly okay to move and get yourself comfortable while you're doing these. So sit comfortably and generate the strong intention to do this meditation in order to develop perfect equanimity for the benefit of yourself and others. Imagine in the space in front of you three people: someone you like, someone you dislike, and someone you feel indifferent to. Retain the images of the friend, the enemy, and the stranger throughout this meditation. First, focus on your friend and ask yourself why you like this person. See if you can recognize that your reasons are mainly because of what she or he does for you. Are those good reasons for liking someone and holding them dear? Take a moment to consider this. Now look at the person you dislike and examine your reasons for feeling that way. Again, check if your ego is involved. For example, the person may have harmed you or may behave in ways that you find unacceptable. Are those good reasons for disliking someone and treating them badly or wishing them harm? Then look at the person you feel indifferent to. Why do you feel this way? Is your ego involved here as well? Is it because this person has neither helped nor harmed you? Also, ask yourself if you regard these relationships as permanent. Do you believe that you will always get along with your friend, that you will never get along with your enemy, and that you will always be distant from the stranger? Recall relationships you had in the past that changed, a friend becoming an enemy or a stranger, or vice versa. Now imagine the friend visualized in front of you doing something hurtful or unacceptable. Would your feelings toward this person change? Recall that this person was not your friend before you became acquainted, and could very easily cease to be your friend in the future. Realize that there is no sound reason for feeling kind and loving toward only the friend of this moment. Relationships changed in the past and will continue to change. Today's friend can become tomorrow's enemy. Now turn your attention to your enemy and imagine this person doing something kind or helpful, such as praising you for something you did, or helping you fix your car which is broken down. Look carefully at your feelings for this person. Are they softening at all? You can learn to feel warmly toward your enemy. This has happened before and will happen again. Why hold so strongly to the conception that this person is definitely enemy? And what of the stranger? This relationship could go either way, but since we're trying to develop more positive feelings for others, imagine the stranger doing something helpful, such as giving you the right directions when you are lost, or returning your wallet which you dropped absentmindedly. How would this affect your feelings toward this person? If you're able to accept the existence of past and future lifetimes, if that's an idea that you're willing to entertain, consider the idea that you have known these three people, the friend, the enemy, and the stranger, before, in other lifetimes, but in very different relationships. Consider that the friend of this lifetime may have been your enemy in another lifetime. Your present enemy may have been someone very dear to you, a parent or sibling or a close friend. And the present stranger may have been both friend and enemy. See how this affects your feelings toward these three people. Understand that relationships are not permanent, but a loved one can become an enemy, and vice versa. A stranger can become either a friend or an enemy. Also, no one is a friend, enemy, or stranger from their own side independently. Rather, they become so independent on how our mind labels them. They become so in dependence on how our mind labels them. Someone you regard as a friend is seen by others as an enemy, and there are people who love the person you regard as an enemy. Therefore, it is unwise to cling to these three types of people as if they were permanent and independently existing. It is also very helpful to recognize that in some ways everyone is equal, exactly the same. One of these ways is that everyone wants to be happy and does not want any problems or pain. Contemplate this. Your friend, enemy, and stranger all want happiness as much as you do. And just like you, they do not want to experience even the smallest problem. And everyone, yourself and others, deserves to be happy and peaceful and free from all suffering. Try to really feel this. Another way in which all beings are equal is that we all have the potential to free our minds from all negativities, develop ourselves to the fullest, and achieve ultimate clarity and compassion. Everyone can and will become enlightened one day. Recognize that the differences we see in people are superficial, based on our mistaken and narrow self-centered viewpoint. If our thoughts and feelings were more in line with reality, we would see that everyone equally deserves our care and compassion. None of this means that we should not discriminate. On a practical level, it is necessary. Naturally, we feel closer to some people and are wise to keep our distance from others. This is not a contradiction. The point of the meditation is to develop equal concern, equal regard for everyone, whether they help or harm us at this point in time, and to see that our present discrimination is based on arbitrary, mistaken, and very changeable labels. So finally, dedicate your positive energy and insight to the well-being and happiness of all. Anyone find that interesting? I like it because it brings across some of the real core messages of what we're trying to do here, which is just realizing that a lot of the things we stress about and a lot of the problems that we have, especially in dealing with people, are based on our views of those people. And we have this very, very reflexive tendency to believe that the way we perceive someone is coming from their side, that this person is this way. Whether we're very attached to that person, we think, you know, we're really, really in love with this person, really, you know, want to be with this person all the time, really like being around this person, have that very strong clinging, you know, that it's coming from them and the way they are. Or the opposite side, when somebody really annoys us, when we have real difficult time dealing with someone, we do tend to think that it's because of the way they are. And I think this meditation, I mean, whether you're ready to fully, you know, buy into all the ideas, it is interesting to reflect on that in this way and think about whether these ideas we have are as concrete as we perceive them, whether these perceptions we have of other people are as solid and coming from their side as we perceive them, and whether they're as permanent and fixed. You know, it's very easy to forget that the person that you're totally in love with was a total stranger to you at some point. You know, maybe. And things change all the time, you know. When you're listening to your best friend complain at length about their horrible boyfriend or girlfriend or whoever it is they're complaining about, it's easy to forget that they were really totally crazy about that person at one point. So these things change. And I think, you know, the realization that comes from this on a practical level helps us deal with situations a little bit more easily. If you can think about this and reflect on it a little, it does help, you know, some of those difficult situations when we're really attached to someone and then they behave in a way that we don't expect or don't like. Or when we're having to deal with that really difficult person. Sometimes just that moment of taking stepping back a little bit and taking a more objective view of things is really helpful. So, you know, there's a practical level to it, and then there's the more in-depth level of looking at the way that we view things, our natural tendency and reflexive way of viewing things and whether it's really accurate. And if anybody is interested, this is a book called How to Meditate by Kathleen McDonald, and it's in the bookstore. You can get it online, too. You'll hear quite like some of the Discovering Buddhism classes in Meditation 101. They talk about this a lot. A lot of the meditations that we discuss or that we'll do here are in this book. So if you're interested, have any interest in all, if you're looking for a book on meditation specifically, this is I know I've gotten a lot out of it, and a lot of other people here feel the same way. So we ran over a little bit. I haven't run over too much yet. Anybody have any quick comments or questions? Or, like I said, I think some of these topics are going to continue over into the next class a little bit. So anything you'd like to talk about and take a little more time to talk about, or if anything comes up during the week, think about it a little bit and we'll maybe have a little more conversation. Maybe see, I think an interesting thing to do is see if you notice, if you're already kind of thinking about things in this way, the way we just talked about, see if you notice any specific examples of when you notice these things happening, you know, where you have this initial reaction to somebody and then you're able to step back and say, oh, wait a minute, maybe that's just a little bit coming from my side. Or maybe you haven't really thought about things this way much and you notice yourself doing that this week. You know, or maybe your initial reaction, your reflex reaction to someone, you're able to, even if it's afterwards, even if it's 2 days later, you go, oh, wow, yeah, I did kind of, you know, snap at that person and maybe I should have realized that was coming from my side a little bit, my reason for being upset. So see if anything like that happens this week. Maybe we'll talk about it next week. Okay. So we'll just take a moment now to dedicate the merits of being here in a positive way. Think about how spending this time, maybe looking at things in a slightly different way from the way we normally do, talking about things, thinking about how it will be a benefit to us, and developing that very strong altruistic wish that any positive actions we've taken here this evening will not just be a benefit to us, but be a benefit to all sentient beings, regardless of what our perception is of those beings, our impermanent perception of those beings. Think that in some way our actions tonight will be of benefit to them.